Thank you. Be seated.
Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Lopez versus Munoz. Hakuna and Reed.
May I please the court? Mr. Kevin H. DeBoe, this is our argument for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 6 minutes for rebuttal.
May I please the court? I'm Kevin DeBoe. I represent the law firm of Munoz, Hakuna and Reed, and each of the individual partners in that firm. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes often wrote about the task of judicial line drawing, observing that it is the constant business of the law to draw difficult lines. He also acknowledged that even the broadest, least controversial standard may well be arbitrary at the margin, and wherever the law draws a line, there will be cases very near each other on opposite sides of the line. Nevertheless, Justice Holmes encouraged courts not to be troubled by the question of where to draw the line, because that is the question in pretty much everything worth arguing in the law. This case is indeed about judicial line drawing on at least one issue and possibly two issues. On the contract issue, this case turns on where the court draws the line about when we can say that a case has been appealed to a higher court. We think the drawing of that line disposes of all of the issues in this case.
How does it dispose of the issue of, even if there's no breach of contract, would you agree that there still may be an excessive fee charge?
It depends. It depends on where that duty comes from.
I thought you were
drawing
lines.
I'm going to draw the line.
Okay.
If we're talking about fiduciary duty, the way that fiduciary duty is pled in this case, it is absolutely dependent on the breach of contract claim.
Okay.
And if the breach...
What if it weren't?
If it weren't, it might be possible to allege other types of breaches of fiduciary duty that were not involved in this case that could result in a finding of a breach by the lawyers. But that's not been pled in this case because the two claims are identical. So that's why we say...
Well, I'm going to presume that your opposing counsel is going to say that we do reach that question.
Right. How
would you respond to that?
And if the court reaches the second question of fiduciary duty, the way that we should be drawn is that the mere amount of a fee by itself does not constitute a breach of fiduciary duty unless it is unaccompanied by some other independent acts of the lawyer that would constitute a breach. For example, if there were evidence that the lawyer had persuaded the client to sign a fee contract that's unreasonable on its face, a 90% contingency fee, something like that. That's a separate act that would cause that to be a breach. If the lawyers are accused of...
Unreasonable on its face is the separate part?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why wouldn't that be true under their argument? In this case, the argument is 5% for nothing done. Unreasonable on its face, basically, their argument.
What the contract says on its face is if the case is appealed, then there's a higher fee. And there's no allegation that the original contract, 40% in general and 45% if the case is appealed, that was unreasonable. That just hasn't been...
The contract also says for services rendered and to be rendered. What was rendered in connection with the 5%?
The contract says that for services rendered, the 40%, and then it also says if the case is appealed to a higher court...
So there was no agreement between the parties that the lawyers would render any services for the 5%? Is that what you're saying?
Not in the contract. That's right. The language that... The sentence that has the 45% in it doesn't say anything.
You think any... I can't think of a reasonable person that would enter into that kind of contract with an understanding that lawyers could receive an additional 5% for doing nothing.
What the contract says is that if the case is appealed to a higher court, then it would be 45%. In most cases, when a case is appealed to a higher court, then the attorneys do have to do a certain amount of work. And that's one of the risks that the clients take. Contingency fee contract inherently involves risk on both sides. The lawyers risk that the case may be lost, that the case may require much more time than they anticipated it would, or that the fee would be reduced. The clients run the risk that there may be circumstances where the fee is settled without much work, or the outcome is excessive, is extremely high, which would give the lawyers a fee. But those risks are balanced by the parties in a contingency fee contract.
Go ahead and finish
the interview. I think I was finished, right?
So you say one circumstance would be if the contract is excessive on its face.
Right.
Are there other circumstances where you could review it in hindsight?
Yes. For example, if the lawyers manipulate facts to affect the outcome. For example, if there were allegations that there was collusion with the other side, where someone called someone and said, you know, I get a higher fee if you file a notice of appeal, there's no allegation of that in this case. There's no proof of that in this case. But if the parties are acting in that way, that may be a breach of fiduciary duty, or if the parties fail to disclose material information about the fee to the clients. And in this case, there was full disclosure to the clients. We're accepting 45% because the case was appealed to a higher court. The only thing that's alleged to have been not represented to clients is when we do this, the breach of the contract. So again, if the contract was not breached, then that disposes of that issue.
Would there have been a breach if the law firm had filed the appeal knowing that that a settlement had been reached? Would that have been a breach of fiduciary duty?
There would at least be a fact issue about that, because you have to go into the motives of the law firm. If there was no reason to do it other than generating a higher fee, then that might be. But again, that's certainly not what happened.
It might be. Why wouldn't that be a breach of fiduciary duty if the only reason of filing the appeal was to increase the fee?
If that is the only reason, I said it would be. There might be some other reason for them filing it, but there would at least be a fact issue about that.
Now, this was a settlement after a judgment.
That's right, Your Honor.
And the settlement was for an amount less than the judgment amount.
That's right.
And so if the settlement wasn't consummated within a relatively short period of time, meaning money was paid and documents were signed, then the party that lost the lawsuit was going to have to appeal. They're going to have to give their notice of appeal to keep that judgment becoming final, which would they lose the benefit of this settlement for less than the amount.
That's right, John. And
must excessiveness of a fee always be determined on the front end?
Yes, it should. And that's what Rule 104 says, that we analyze the unconscionability of fees, which that rule prohibits, based on the circumstances that existed at the time the contract was made.
But if we do that, then we eliminate the circumstance that you were just describing, where, for example, there's collusion between the two lawyers to get a notice of appeal filed so it could trigger an additional 5%.
Right, and that, what I said, also be a breach of fiduciary duty, but not based solely on the excessiveness of the fee, not based on the amount of the fee, but on some other independent act in connection with the fee that would cause that breach.
So you're advocating a position that we should never look at whether a fee is excessive based on the services actually rendered or the subsequent course of events after the contract has been entered.
That's right, John.
Who decides if a fee is excessive?
That's probably a law question for the court. If there's an allegation that a contract on its face is excessive, it may be that the restatement of the rule governing the law of lawyers says that one of the relevant factors that you consider is whether it's out of line with other fees caused in that region, other fees charged by other reasonable lawyers. And it may be that you would put on evidence that the typical fee is 40 to 45%, and this lawyer.
If every lawyer in this community started charging 75%, would that set the standard?
According to what the restatement, well, that's one of the factors that the court considers. That wouldn't necessarily be the dispositive factor. But at some point, if everybody's charging a fee, then charging the same fee that everybody else charges is not an unreasonable fee.
So contingent fees, then, if the community is allowing them at a certain level, would never be excessive? Nor would billing someone $2,000 an hour and signing that kind of an agreement, as long as there were others that were doing it?
It would not, at least not be out of line with what the community standards are. And again, as the restatement says, that's one of the factors that you look at. It's not the only factor. But if it's what everybody else is charging, then at least that factor is satisfied.
How does the client's expectations fit into this? I mean, if we're looking at just what the lawyers are charging, and that's what they think the market will bear, how does the client and the expectations of the client fit into the analysis of whether or not the fee is excessive at the front end?
That is certainly one of the factors that you look at. And in this case, there is no evidence about what these clients expected. And it's likely that this is not a situation where a client appreciated the difference between perfecting appeal and filing a notice of appeal and all the other steps on appeal, but that they were told ahead of time that if the case is appealed, then it will be at a higher rate, and there's no evidence that they expected anything other than that.
Well, how does the expectation of the client fit into your bright line test at the front end?
Well, I don't think it fits into the bright line test. I think if you adopt the restatement test that suggests that we ought to take this backwards-looking reasonableness view, which we don't think any Texas court has taken and don't think they should, but if you do apply that test, the restatement, in addition to a number of other factors, says that you ought to look at the client's
Let me ask you a hypothetical. Let's assume that a lawyer knows, in this case, that Westinghouse is about to offer an injured person $15 million in settlement, and the injured person is not represented. They run out and sign up a contingency fee agreement that provides for 40%. And the next day, Westinghouse does, in fact, offer the $15 million in settlement, not knowing even that the injured party is represented. Is the lawyer entitled to 40% of the $15 million?
The example you suggest, Justice Sullivan, is very similar to an example discussed in the restatement of the law, of the law governing lawyers. Section 46 gives an illustration in a criminal case where an attorney accepts a fee of $15,000, and the next case someone else confesses to the offense and the charges are dropped. And the restatement in connection to that illustration says, under those circumstances, when the lawyer has done nothing, and because of some other circumstances...
Well, but here, the lawyer knows that the $15 million offer is coming, that the injured party doesn't know, and the lawyer says, I see an opportunity to get 40% of $15 million if I go out and sign this person up.
Right.
Are they entitled to the fee under those circumstances?
Well, it's unclear based on what the restatement says, because the restatement says that if the lawyer does nothing, the charges are just dropped.
Well, they've reached a fiduciary duty to the client by not saying, at the time that they sign them up, say, you know, I know that you're probably going to get an offer tomorrow for $15 million, and I want to disclose that to you, but they don't.
Right, and that's one of the factors that I suggest in the Bright Line test, one of the other independent acts that would justify a finding of a breach of fiduciary duty.
So under those circumstances, could a court say, yes, you breached your fiduciary duty because you had superior knowledge?
Yes, they could. And that's one of the instances I suggested as an exception.
In this case, wasn't there evidence that on October 14th, the trial counsel in this case, the plaintiff's counsel, knew that a settlement offer was coming and knew that no appeal had yet been filed? Basically told the other side that it was settled and went ahead and calculated the 45% even before the appeal had been filed.
There's not any evidence that the trial lawyers calculated that amount before the appeal was filed.
Isn't there a document dated October 14th with a 45% calculation?
There's a document by a CPA, a man named Bailey, who was hired by the Lopezes as their CPA, who did a calculation, may have done other calculations that day, as a date at the top of the page, but there's no evidence that the lawyers ever supplied that information or that the lawyers ever planned to take a higher fee before the case was appealed.
Let me ask you on this. You said the excessiveness of a fee is measured by the prospective view under the facts as known. Under Justice Owens' example, that would be an excessive fee case. That would be the lawyer knew circumstances and set a fee with that knowledge, and you look at that, and it's a $15 million settlement that the lawyer knew was coming down, and he just arbitrarily got an agreement. That would be an excessive fee case.
Right.
The restatement, you use an example where the lawyer gets $15,000 to represent a criminal case, and the next day the case is charged and the lawyer has done nothing for that, is a little bit different scenario. But it looks to me that the restatement says that could be an excessive fee case because the lawyer, the result obtained without a lawyer doing any work, and therefore the lawyer had not earned the fee the lawyer had been paid. And it says that's an excessive fee case. On a contingent fee, where the lawyer takes a risk not knowing anything about the case, a settlement comes down the next day for $15 million. The lawyer didn't know it was coming down. This lawyer saw this is a significant damage case, $15 million, significant damage case. The plaintiff comes, the lawyer says, I need representation. The lawyer says, fine, signs up for contingent fee. The next day it settles. It seems to me that would fit within that scenario of excessive fee.
The answer to that falls in what the restatement says about that example in the criminal case with the $15,000. Because even though the restatement says if the lawyer does nothing and the case is criminal charges are dropped the next day, that would might be an excessive fee. That same illustration, which is illustration one under comment C of section 46, says if, however, the prosecutor dropped the charges as the result of a plea bargain negotiated by the lawyer, the rapid disposition would not render unreasonable an otherwise proper flat fee.
Well, I recognize that. I'm just saying, taking the scenario, the lawyer gets $15,000, the case is dropped, the lawyer just does nothing, that's excessive fee. Contingency fee. Lawyer, no imbalance in information at all. Plaintiff
right.
comes and I've got serious injuries, the lawyer says, yes, you do, takes 40% contingency. The next day, $15 million is offered to the plaintiff, the plaintiff wants to take it, and the lawyer hasn't negotiated that. There's no, it's just, that's the offer that's there, the plaintiff says they want to take it. Is that an excessive fee circumstance?
We say that you look at the contract. And under the contract, that would not be. If you adopt
because,
it,
why?
Because under the contract, that's what the lawyer would be entitled to.
But the criminal case, the $15,000, where the lawyer did nothing to get the charges dropped, the lawyer was just hired by the client, the restatement says that's excessive fee.
Right. And that theory has never been adopted in this state, and we're saying that in this case, you look at the contract. But even if you do
take
that...
Well, let me be clear. What you're saying is because that's a retrospective view, that should not be an excessive fee case. You have to look at it prospectively. When they took $15,000, it's a serious case, and regardless of how it's resolved later, that cannot be an excessive fee case.
That's right.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counselor. Court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Dan Poza will present argument from the respondents.
May it please the court. A lawyer's fiduciary obligation is embedded, if I can characterize it that way, is embedded in the performance of his or her contract. That is, once that contract is formed and that lawyer begins representation of that client, those fiduciary obligations are there, and they are a part of that throughout the performance of that contract. And that contract
is, it seems to me that the lawyers here did a pretty good job for your client. They got a $25 million jury verdict, $15 million settlement. Now you're asking that they forfeit all of their legal fees.
I am, Your Honor.
Why aren't they entitled to keep some of them?
The reason why I think the amount, it should be the entire amount, is because of the events that occurred in October of 1991, that we do look at it at a minimum from the standpoint of their fiduciary obligation, if I might explain what I mean by that. They seek a bright line here. They did not provide one. So we have this appeal to a higher court. I don't think that's a term of art. I think it gets given its common meaning. Because of that, they find themselves in October of 1991 in this situation. The case is settled for $15 million. Whether it's settled before the perfection or not is not relevant to this analysis. As fiduciaries, though, they have a contract that says appeal to a higher court, and they are there in October of 1991, and they're saying, how are we going to split this up? They make the determination as late as October 30, 1991, I think the decision's made earlier, but October 30, 1991, they still have a chance to split it up the way they should. But on October 30, 1991, here's what they know, and you only have to look at Mr. Hockema's affidavit, 59 and 60 of the clerk's record, for this evidence. On October 30, 1991, Mr. Hockema knows this. He knows that they have not done a lick of work on an appeal from October 18 to October 30. He knows that they've not done any of that. He knows that the $15 million that they've gotten to Lopez's is the same demand they made to Russell McMaines on September 25th. They're now settling post-filing of the cash deposit for the same amount. So they've not added a penny to what the client's going to get. And now they're looking at their contract, and they're saying appeal to a higher court. You know, by the way, the appeal to a higher court, you don't walk that language into perfection, into appeal to a higher court.
How would you define appeal to a higher court?
Your Honor, the way that we give it its plain, common meaning, and we also invoke, in effect, Section 29A of the Restatement Third of Law Governing Lawyers, which does from what would be the reasonable expectation of the client. And there is, I think, a 1971 case from the Texas Supreme Court that says in interpreting contracts, we look at words, and those words point to things. They point to external things.
What?
In this case, do they point to a higher court? So if someone
that's
looking
what
at
you do.
Pardon me?
That's what you do when you post a cash bond. You're in a higher court.
Well, I'm saying from the terms of the contract itself, if you were just looking at it from the certainly from the expectations of the clients, you would see appeal to a higher court. That would point me to a higher court. That would point me to an appeal. I would go to that higher court. I would not find an appeal there. That may be overly simplistic, but my opinion is that that oversimplistic, even if that's oversimplistic, that's a more rational way, common sense looking at it than their version, because they would like to tell you, they tell you, that their version is just as simple. But when you analyze it, when you sort of deconstruct it, if you
so
will.
So are you saying if the rules provided that to perfect an appeal, you have to file a cost bond with the appeals court, your result would be different?
Well, I guess, I'm not saying that that would be the case. No, I'm not. Let's put it this way. I guess I'm saying two things, depending on whether we're looking at it from a breach of contract prospectively or not. If we're saying appeal to a higher court and giving it a reasonable construction, I think there has to be an appeal in a higher court.
When
I
would
think
that
the
be?
Question,
when
well,
would the
that
first
very,
moment that that would be?
Well, that very well may be when there's something happens in that higher court, whether it's docketed or whatever else. I'm not saying it's sufficient, but at least at that point, something's happened. The problem in this case, though, is that they did not use a term of art when they decided what the stair step, what the triggering event would be. And because they did not use a term of art, there isn't that external thing that you can point to from the contract that would be a term of art. So in October of 1991, they have a looseness in their contract that they've got to resolve. And what I'm saying is they had the obligation to not self-deal at the moment when they attempted to resolve that.
Well, let me ask you this. If we were to determine that appeal to the higher court was met by the filing of the cost bond, and there was no breach of contract, does that take care of the fiduciary duty claim?
No, ma'am.
Now, I believe the Court of Appeals said that they were one and the same. Do you disagree with that?
No, the court's analysis, we don't disagree with the court's results. The court's analysis was that the breach of contract also was a breach of fiduciary duty. That act was breach of contract.
I read their opinion to say that your breach of fiduciary duty, as pled, was solely the breach of contract.
I don't think our pleading's tied together. Certainly our briefing is tied together because we are of the opinion that the breach of contract is also a breach of fiduciary duty. But our pleadings don't restrict us that way. And certainly one can have a breach of fiduciary duty without having a breach of contract.
But maybe my question's not clear. Didn't the Court of Appeals say that they were one and the same, that disposition of the contract claim would satisfy the fiduciary duty claim?
That's the way they treat it.
And isn't that the basis upon which they took jurisdiction?
That's the way they took jurisdiction. They said there was no breach of contract, and because that was connected to the breach of fiduciary duty, the trial court's decision that there was no breach of contract in effect disposed of everything else.
Right.
Everything was predicated.
And what does it do to the jurisdiction argument if we say, as you say, they're not tied together? What does it do to the jurisdiction final judgment argument?
Without a severance, I'm not sure what the jurisdictional aspects would be. I mean,
aren't you in a bit of a catch-22 there?
Right.
I mean, you're either tied to it or you're not.
Right.
If you're not, we have a jurisdiction problem. Right. If you are, we only dispose of the contract claim. And how do you want us to decide that?
Well, first, we're happy to be tied to it for other than parochial jurisdictional reasons that might be beneficial to us, because we see that there is that connection there. If that connection is not there, then there's no question of jurisdictional issue.
Don't you have, isn't your claim for breach of fiduciary duty barred by limitations?
Your Honor, it's our belief that limitations for you. The recent...
Is that a settled issue or unsettled? And that's how
well, this is sort of a separation of powers issue that I don't want to get in the middle of. The legislature has, I guess there was an act that was passed, and it's a codification now of Civil Practice and Remedies Code, and they plug into Section 16, whatever, fraud and breach of fiduciary duty. And then I think in Section 2, they say, well, this is clarifying differences of opinion amongst the courts of appeals, and they sort of imply we're not changing law. It's always been that way. This court might someday determine that that's not the case, and again, I don't want to get in the middle of that, but we do take the position that breach of fiduciary duty is a four-year statute of limitations, and therefore would not be no more applicable on that claim.
Under what circumstances will an attorney's fee be excessive, and at what point in time in the attorney-client relationship should that determination be made?
And I believe an attorney's fee contract can be drawn in such a way that it is reasonable at the outset. And if performed in accordance with that contract, that's all you'd have to look at. I'm saying that they could have drawn a contract that worked. They didn't. And because, and I guess what I'm trying to make on my connection to October of 1991, it's because they didn't. It's because there was looseness of the language. It's because they had to, they should not have had a decision to make where they had to balance their interests against their client's interests in October 1991. They drew that contract, they drew it that way, and it gave them that looseness.
You say it's loose. Are you saying it's ambiguous?
Well, I don't claim to be an expert on interpreting contracts, but there's a lot of what, when we engage in primary rules of construction, there's a lot of things about interpreting those words that one could say, well, we're really involved in ambiguity. We've sort of taken it as a secondary position that if it is ambiguous, contra pro parentum, we come to the same result because we construe it against the drawing part, especially fiduciary.
By perfecting appeal under the rules of appellate procedure, would the 5% additional fee have been unreasonable and excessive?
I think if it had said perfecting, if it had used the term of art, filing an original petition, perfecting an appeal, it would not be unreasonable.
So you're,
I'm not saying
your problem is not with the 5% for not doing any work. Your problem is with the trigger.
Well, it's not quite right, and let me tell you why that's not quite right. The problem is this. Because they don't use the term of art, that they're left with the ambiguity. It's because they're left with the ambiguity that fiduciary duties and obligations do come into play in their decision on how to cut that settlement up in October of 1991. And so I guess what I'm saying is it's not just, well, they could have done it better and they didn't, no harm, no foul. I'm not saying that whatsoever. I'm saying they drew a contract. They permitted, whether we call it an ambiguity for contract purposes or something where there was enough looseness in the language where they had to interpret it, then they had that, they did not necessarily have to interpret it. They drew a contract, they had to interpret. When they did that, they had to decide between their interest and their client's interest. They chose their interest, and that was a violation both of the contract based on our construction, and certainly.
Just so I'm clear about this, if the language had said what Justice Tech just said, perfecting an appeal under the rules of procedure, you would not have a breach of fiduciary argument.
I think that's right. I mean, the facts that aren't here, or at least that we don't think are here, about them manipulating to get to the triggering event. But in the absence of that, I agree.
Now, if you think it's clear as day, do you have a breach of fiduciary argument?
If it's on its face and if it's...
We think that. You think you take a position that's ambiguous. If we decide that it's clear, do you still make a breach of fiduciary argument? That, well,
yes, sir.
We finally decided it, but at the back of the time, you didn't know.
Yes, sir.
In light of your argument, if you're right, wasn't the Court of Appeals result right to limit this to the 5% additional? But why should this, I guess they drew a contract and they weren't clear enough, why should that jeopardize their entire fee or a substantial portion of
right.
it under Burrow to be left to
right.
that determination?
And Judge, no question we're asking that it all our substantial part. I mean, I don't think we've been
reluctant
on that.
I know that.
Again, I think, Judge, it goes back to the state of affairs in October of 1991, which are very relevant on the fiduciary obligation because of the looseness of the contract. I mean, they had a decision to make as to whether that was an appeal to a higher court based upon their fiduciary obligations and the work they had done, the amount that they had gotten in excess of what they were demanding.
So let's assume we say it's not ambiguous. An appeal was perfected. Do you still say there's a breach of fiduciary duty?
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
Can you articulate that
point? Yes. If this court construes as a legal matter that appeal to, that perfection is an appeal to a higher court, that doesn't change the events of October of 1991.
Why would it have been unreasonable for the lawyers to draw the same conclusion at that point in time? I just think they've been mistaken.
Your Honor, I think, frankly, remembering again that I may not accept the premise, but Even if that's the case, I think a lawyer, unless they have the clarity, now it may be that this court wishes to give it that clarity because it may mean that, but there's no question that in the contract that they drew, they don't state that. They don't use that language. So in the contract that they drew, they had to make a decision, and I think when they had to make a decision, it's a different kind of decision than this court makes, because this court is not in a fiduciary relationship with those clients. When they make that decision, I think they have to make it as fiduciaries, and if there's any sort of play in it, as I believe there, I mean, as there obviously is, because it doesn't say perfection in the contract, they can't self-deal, which they clearly do.
So if you get in a fee dispute, and there's reasonable arguments on both sides, but the court has to make the call as a legal matter, and the client loses, the client still wins on breach of fiduciary duty, because you're saying the lawyer shouldn't challenge it when there's basis for disagreement?
No, I guess what I'm saying is that if there's facts that would, they should, put this way, the client should have the opportunity to determine whether or not there's a fiduciary violation in connection with the performance of that contract.
The firm should have told the client, look, we think you owe 45, but you may only owe 40.
Correct.
Do you agree with petitioner's counsel that whether a fee is excessive is a question of law?
Yes. I mean, there may be, like Burroughs, there may be factual predicates that go into the determination, but yes.
And when should that determination be made? When during the attorney-client relationship? Do we wait to see what kind of work the lawyer does? Do you determine it at the front end and never consider the subsequent events?
I think there has to be a recognition of libertarian freedom of contract principles, notwithstanding fiduciary obligations, no question about that. However, I think those fiduciary obligations are very important, and I think as embedded as they are into the performance, that unlike perhaps other interpretations of contracts, I don't think you rule out, nor would you just have a general rule ruling out the evaluation of the lawyer's performance under the contract.
Well, let's suppose, again, the hypothetical we talked about before, that you had signed up a client for 40% contingency fee, and the very day after that contract was inked, Westinghouse made a $15 million offer. All that you did was sign up the contingency agreement and have an initial interview with the client. Would you say that the lawyer would breach a fiduciary duty if they accepted the 40% fee?
Yes, in the sense of what Justice Hankinson was saying, that would be an example of why you would not preclude the client being able to say, notwithstanding the contract, the performance was such that fiduciary issues are involved and they need to be evaluated. In that case, I think there would be a breach.
What would the lawyer have to do to earn the 40% contingency fee?
Well, I think there has to be some causal connection with the lawyer being, in your situation, I would think there has to be some causal connection between the lawyer being hired and the amount being offered.
Well, let's say the lawyer writes a demand letter, but it crosses in the mail with the settlement offer.
Well, I don't think there are causal connections there. I mean, if our friend Joe Jamail picks up the phone and says, I'm representing X, and they say $15 million, one might very well say, well, you know, it's a good causal connection. By the same token, anyone else might be a good cause. I think there has to be some connection between the representation and the result that occurs.
Well, as I understand Mr. Bowe's argument, he says if your complaint is an excessive fee complaint, then the excessive fee has to be determined at the outset of the relationship to avoid the problem that every fee dispute turns into a breach of fiduciary claim. Their argument is that you look to the contract to see that in the event an appeal is filed, it's 45% an excessive fee. Your argument seems to be that if you have discrete triggers in the contract, then whenever the trigger is pulled, you have to look at the circumstances at the time the trigger is pulled to determine if it's an excessive fee, so that this additional 5% for the appellate work that wasn't done, looking at as the parties were looking. We're not anticipating an appeal. We're not anticipating having to respond to an appeal. This is just simply a way to keep the judgment alive so the settlement can be done. Was 5% of the recovery an excessive fee? And you argue that it was excessive. That's your argument. You're really not arguing that 45% is excessive. You're arguing that the 5% is excessive.
I guess two things. One, I'm arguing that in the circumstances, we can look at the circumstances present October 1991, they had not earned it, and they took money that wasn't owed, that they were not owed. I mean, they took money from the client for doing nothing. And I guess similarly, what Justice Gonzalez had said earlier, I think it was, in construing the contract, I think if the contract says or can be construed for services rendered, there will be this trigger, then I think the contract itself points to looking at activity that occurred at the time of the triggering event.
Do you say that 45%, looking at the contract from the date it was entered into, would 45% been in? Are you arguing that that's an excessive fee?
I'm not.
If the contract is clear, but wasn't clear at the time, and so there is a breach of fiduciary duty, are there any actual damages from that breach?
In this case, certainly.
If the contract was clear, they're not entitled to the fee. I mean, the firm is entitled to the fee. If we think the firm was entitled to the fee because the trigger happened, but it wasn't clear then, so maybe there was a breach of fiduciary duty, are there any actual damages?
Probably, well, there'd be actual damages in the boroughs versus ours category, I imagine.
If
I understand what you're saying.
No actual damages, but you're still seeking a forfeiture.
Yeah, it'd be a whole different, the nature of the forfeiture remedy would vary greatly if the conduct, but the example you're giving me is the contract is fine, they're absolutely entitled to $750,000, they did take it, whether they guessed right or not, when they made that decision October 1991, whether it's luck or not, or whatever their mental frame of mind was, they were entitled to it and they took it. There could be a breach of fiduciary duty, the damages, forfeiture might be appropriate, but it might be more in the borough's box, I think, I hope that's not the case.
With breach of fiduciary duty, is, my understanding of what you're saying here today is the breach of fiduciary duty is, was their failure at the time the settlement was funded to reveal that there may be a dispute as to what the appeals were around for me.
I think the best evidence, certainly, of their breach of fiduciary duty is the events in October of 1991 and the fact that they should have told the client, we haven't earned this fee, and here are these words, appeal to a higher court, and we're going to tell you there's an appeal.
Well, but, again, the resolution of the contract issue would involve that posing of the fiduciary question. I guess my question is separate and apart from the contract. My understanding is you're saying that just by not revealing to the client that this could be disputed, is that in and of itself a breach of fiduciary duty?
I think it is here, where it's connected to for services rendered that have not been rendered.
Has that been pled or argued anywhere?
Well, I don't know if it's not been pled in the sense that we've not had any pleading of that kind of detail, and that is not the way the argument of briefing is going.
And that was not what the trial court decided for summary judgment.
No, the trial court decided, well, whatever the order is, the breach of contract issue disposed of it.
Any other questions? Thank you, Kevin.
May it please the court, David McGillan, to present the rebuttal for the petitioners.
Please the court, I'd like to start with Justice Owens' hypothetical about the very quick settlement and the variations on that theme, because for every hypothetical of a quick settlement close to the trigger, there is an equal and opposite hypothetical at the other end of the spectrum. Obviously, it's a continuum, and an infinite number of things can happen. But that's why we are resisting as strongly as we can the restatement illustration. The focus seems to be misplaced in the restatement. The focus in the restatement seems to melt over into compensation for work being done, which I don't think is the right test at all. And that's why I think it's off base for the plaintiffs to argue they did nothing. We're not being paid for doing anything. We might have done a million hours of work for 20 years, but that wouldn't alter the compensation arrangement. These contracts are not about work. They are about risk, and they are good for clients. If the hard cases fall apart when it's close to the line in the hypotheticals like Justice Owen appropriately asked, then that is a chill on the ability to negotiate this kind of deal with the client up front. Clients need these caps on how much they're going to have to pay, whatever form it takes, flat fee, some sort of stair step. It is good for clients. And because there are hypos at this end, there are also hypos at that end, it's going to be a trade-off.
Okay, Mr. Gunn, let me ask in that regard, if you have a contract that triggers levels of fees, would it be inappropriate for the court to consider prospectively the excessiveness of the incremental increase in the fee when that trigger occurs. So it's 40% through trial, it's 45% in the event of an appeal. Well, you get to the trigger time. Would it not be appropriate for the court to look at the triggering circumstances and say you have the right to charge under your contract a fee of 5% additional of the recovery in the event it's appealed? But looking at it prospectively, we all know that this appeal is meaningless to the extent that we've already got an agreement and it's just a delay time to keep the judgment. Would it not be appropriate for the court to look at the discrete triggers to determine whether the trigger is excessive?
Well, it sounds to me, when you say prospective, you're actually saying sort of in the middle of things, after the trial but before the appeal.
Before, at the event that the trigger that would entitle additional fees that would not otherwise be entitled.
It would be inappropriate to judge it at that point in time, after we know what the judgment is and before we know what's happening on appeal, unless the lawyer's negotiating the appellate fees at that time. For example, we don't do trial work. If the clients had come to us at that point and said, we have a judgment in hand, would you negotiate a fee with us to defend the case against Rusty on the other side when Westinghouse appeals? Then it would be appropriate to judge our contract that way. But remember, this 5% stair step that we're going to judge was signed 2 years before the trial, before the case had even been filed. So that is the only point in time we can judge it. And I think that's what Archer versus Griffith pretty much nails down.
You're saying if we, on appeal, for example, they come to you and say, we'll give you 15% of anything that we win to handle the appeal, and the trial counsel doesn't know you've been retained, and that same day they offer $15 million and the case is settled, and you don't do a lick of work. You're, under your theory, you're still entitled to 15% because you were hired as appellate counsel.
I think that's right, subject to ordinary policing of contracts, escapes for fraud, overreaching, duress, mutual.
There was no collusion on your part, just that's the way it's
right. If I'm taking a risk.
What's your risk in that scenario?
Well, I'm not sure I quite understood all the facts.
Okay, let's say that there's been a judgment in a plaintiff's failure, and they're concerned that Westinghouse is going to appeal, and they want to hire you on appeal. The plaintiff comes to you and says, I'll give you another 15% of my, if I prevail, if I keep my judgment, if you'll represent me on appeal, and you say fine, you sign the document. That same day, Westinghouse doesn't know you've been hired as appellate counsel. They telephone trial counsel and offer the plaintiff $15 million. The plaintiff accepts it. So that you never do any work.
Right.
Where is your risk in that scenario?
Well, my risk is that the settlement doesn't go through, that Westinghouse doesn't offer that. If when the client signs up with me, I have a risk of having to fight Rusty for several years through the courts, then I have taken the risk. Now, 15% may be too high. And if that's out of bounds, we police that and say that's just too much. But we do it because it was too high at the moment of the case being signed up. The fact that the case settled the next day, I can't find a principal stopping point. If one day is the stopping point, if that's too much, I don't know where to draw the line. To me, the question is, what is the risk at the moment I negotiate as an arm's length matter with that prospective client?
But it could be excessive on that day.
Absolutely.
Just because of the amount.
Absolutely. If I said, all right, you've paid your trial lawyers 40%, pay me another 40% for the appeal, matter of law, that's going to be too much. I'd like to answer Justice O'Neill's question about...
Where is this matter of law?
I'm saying it would be a matter of law if I charge
40%. 80 is and 45 isn't. So it's somewhere in between there is this difficult line.
It is between there. It's out of bounds, and I don't know where I would make that call if I were a trial judge. But that's no different from avoidance devices for contract law generally. We have avoidance devices for unconscionability generally.
I would like the answer.
Well, Justice O'Neill, you asked about the fusion of contract and fiduciary duty. And they are the same here. Page 12 of the other side's brief says that the conduct which gives rise to the breach of contract is the same conduct which constitutes a violation of the fiduciary duty. That's why they moved to sever. They didn't just move for partial summary judgment on contract and fiduciary duty. They moved for summary judgment on those two claims and moved to sever them out and said that they are separate from the other claims in the case.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, President. Second argument. The court will take another brief recess.